Good evening, everyone. I'm your host, Jason Miles, and welcome to another episode of This is Revolution Podcast. So glad to have you here with us as we were getting ready in the virtual green room and looking over to our, will be my right. I can't speak for everyone else. And we can see the chat move. Some of the comments that you guys made for why we were a bit tardy are hilarious, by the way. My favorite so far is Jason is trying on different outfits and Ben is trying to tell me to pick just one. No, that's not why we were late. We were just telling jokes with each other in the back as we haven't been on the same screen together in a long time, and we haven't been all in the same place in a long time. For those new to the show, thank you so much for checking this out. If you enjoy what you're seeing, hopefully you hit like and subscribe on your way out and become part of the gang. And for those returning people, glad to have you back. This is going to be a fun show because when Ben hit me up about the article, I said, I think it would make sense to bring on, you know, some of the foreign policy members of the Central Committee. So, coming in hot somewhere in the great northwestern region of British Columbia, please welcome Deep State Kumba.
Hello, everyone. I guess in the Central Committee, I would be the Vice Commissar for Ewok Affairs.
And we have actually everyone's favorite professor at Missouri State University, and he is being joined by his soon-to-be 5-year-old son, Mean Gene Bajlan.
Eid Mubarak, comrades and friends, Jezhne Prozbe, and long live the fighters of Modi.
I'm waiting to see the first person get canceled for a Dune-related tweet.
Never mind.
That's misconstrued as support for Hamas.
Does not work
that, yeah, I'm waiting for that. I've turned my Facebook feed into basically a Dune meme feed.
That's and don't you feel better already?
I feel so much better. All I see is Dune memes.
Now you see why all I do is try to find toy memes and silly stuff, because I don't want to see.
Check what we've got.
What is that? Is that a Ninja Turtle?
That's Rocksteady.
That's a Ninja Turtle.
Oh.
Well, it's not a Ninja Turtle. It's
He's a Ninja Turtle antagonist.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, get it right, bro.
I really hope you didn't call it a Ninja Turtle.
Allegiance to losers.
Oh.
No, it's an accident.
But that's what you get for getting that kid Rocksteady and not a Ninja Turtle.
Well, it was it was a present from his uncle.
What a mean uncle.
It's not mean. What's wrong with Rocksteady? He's a good character. Rocksteady, Bebop and Rocksteady actually are the ones who, at the end of the day, get the fuel that they need to get the Technodrome from out of the center of the Earth. Because
the essential proletarian.
Yeah, like they mess up everything for every single episode, but there's one episode where Shredder and the Turtles are off doing some real dumb shit, and then Bebop and everybody's like not paying attention to Bebop and Rocksteady, and they just steal some nuclear missiles, and boom, the Technodrome's back on Earth. So I think Bebop and Rocksteady deserve a lot more credit, and I think, frankly, it's racist that people are against Bebop and Rocksteady because they're coded black. And they're portrayed as being stupid, right? Just like Michelangelo, right? And the reason they put Michelangelo in that don't take drugs advert was because that was part of Michelangelo's community service, right?
Yeah, but he's coded. Is he coded black? I always thought of him as a California surfer dude.
Yeah
maybe he's coded purple. Yeah, he's coded. But Bebop and Rocksteady are definitely coded as people of color. And Shredder is a Mexican.
Uncle Phil?
Yeah, Uncle Phil, yeah. Uncle Phil is also the voice of Rao the Conqueror of the World in Fist of the North Star.
I didn't know that. The American.
Anyway, bring Ben on because we're supposed to be talking about something serious.
Speak for yourself. Are land acknowledgments simply performative liberal politics, or can they help us in having a better understanding of the history of a settler colonial past? Our guest today points out the more problematic aspect of denying one human rights, regardless of whose ancestors were there first, from Ben Burgess's piece in Jacobin titled, No One's Rights Should Depend on Where Their Ancestors Lived. The great German socialist thinker, August Bebel, famously said that anti-Semitism is the socialism of fools, since anti-Semites tend to scapegoat cabals of Jewish bankers for the problems of an entire economic system. To tweak Bebel's observation a bit, this kind of rhetoric about all Israelis being settlers whose presence in their country is illegitimate represents the anti-Zionism of fools. Zionism should be rejected because ethnostates are wrong in principle. No nation state should be a state of a specific ethnic religious subset of its residents, and the most just solution would be a single secular democratic state with equal rights for everyone. People who insist that Palestinians are indigenous and Israelis are not, and who think this is what makes the struggle for Palestinian rights legitimate, are embracing the logic of reactionaries like Tenney and Shapiro. We're going to get into that later in the show, while reversing the implication. The problem with the rights claim that Israel is justified in denying basic rights to millions of people because of historical Jewish claims to Judea and Samaria is not that the right wingers are misidentifying who counts as truly religious or indigenous. The wildly reactionary premise is that this is even a relevant question. He's the host of Give Them an Argument, my former neighbor and my current best friend. Please welcome Ben Burgess.
Yeah. Michelangelo isn't black. I'm pretty sure. I mean, obviously he's like one of this like brood of turtles who was, you know, who's raised in the sewer. But in terms of the sort of human he's coded as, I think approximately Michelangelo is like a dude who grew up in Santa Monica, whose like dad is Jewish, and like his mom is like.
Oh, so he's a Beastie Boy.
You know, lapsed Presbyterian. You know, that's who Michelangelo is. He was always my favorite turtle.
But that's the human of Michelangelo. You also point out that the turtle part, that's very urban, right?
Yeah,
the city
urban.
I've never heard anybody make a turtle sound offensive, and then you meet Gene.
Challenge accepted.
It's fine to give Zal a rock steady. I mean, I was when I was like 13, 14, and my brother and my cousin were like 6 and 7. You know, I mean, they were always played turtles, and I always played Shredder happily, right? You know, that's the we can embrace all of the characters in the strange melodrama.
To me, there's certain characters that when you get them as a child, they're the characters that were in the bargain bin. I'm older than everybody, so Star Wars characters like the white guy that had the mechanical thing on his bald head from Cloud City.
Yeah, I remember him.
He didn't even have a gun. He just had like a flowy little.
He had a speed gun because he hands out traffic tickets.
Cuba knows him. He probably promoted him.
He got promoted. He's an alderman now. He's the alderman of Cloud City.
He's the alderman of Cloud City. Yeah, he's Cloud City.
Lobot, yeah. If you had Lobot, that meant that somebody got that on the way to your birthday party at McDonald's.
It's brutal.
Yeah, he used to be an alderman. He got the job giving out the traffic tickets. It was like a political boondoggle job, you know, that like
County Hall of Cloud City. That's
he only has to work for 45 minutes exactly. A week. He draws his paycheck.
The Lobots that guy, are not a huge
that guy and the pilot, but also the pilot for the Cloud City like plane, and the dude whose arm was like this.
Yeah, yeah,
so
yeah.
All
yeah.
He could do was salute. Horrible to me.
Someone needs to do they need to do a reboot. They need to do a Cloud City spin-off series based on The Wire. That's what we.
I mean,
because of someone getting chucked off Cloud City. That's what. See, he's quite happy with his Rocksteady. Rocksteady has a gun. Rocksteady has a gun. Does Michelangelo have a gun? No, he just has, you know, a quarter bag of weed.
A quarter bag of weed.
And some nunchucks. He's basically every 15-year-old.
Wait. I thought you said that Michelangelo is black-coated.
No. Ben's persuaded me that he's probably due to certain features, he might actually be descended from Ben's people.
So he actually has a right to Alia, and now he's retired, right?
He's basically he's probably got Lenny Kravitz's racial makeup. Are we doing racial?
I figured we were going to ease into it maybe towards the end, because I do have some like setups for those.
Get to it. I'm.
But we you know, sometimes you just skinny dip in the deep end as you walk into the public pool. Ben.
Sure.
Welcome. For those new watching the show, welcome to This Is Revolution. Ben, you start your article off discussing New York Congresswoman Claudia Tenney.
Yes.
She is introducing an act that will stop referring to the West Bank and Gaza as the West Bank, the occupied West Bank, and call it Judea and Samaria. Has the right adopted the liberal speak of indigenous ancestral lands and land acknowledgments?
Yeah, so I mean, some of them certainly have, right? So the two, so I, you know, kind of start out talking about Claudia Tenney because that's the news hook, and I also think it's very funny to think about Claudia Tenney representing New York 14s. So that's an upstate New York congressional district. Who, you know, wants to U.S. government documents to refer to the West Bank as Judea and Samaria. And, you know, the idea seems to be that Israel should have a claim to the West Bank because there were these, you know, ancient Jewish kingdoms there thousands of years ago, when, of course, we could go back just a few hundred years and New York 14 was by and large the Iroquois Confederacy. Right. That's where, you know, that's where that was. Presumably, you know, she presumably Claudia thinks that she should be allowed to, you know, have political rights and, you know, and all that stuff there, despite not being, you know, descended from that earlier group. And then the other example I give is a friend of the show, Ben Shapiro, who recently was at the Cambridge Union and you know, argued with the students there. It's Ben Shapiro's favorite thing to do is argue with college students, undergraduates. In this case, he was doing it at a fancy setting at the Cambridge Union. And there's, you know, part of that where he, you know, he was talking about the left and decolonization, all that. He said, look, Israel should be the ultimate example of decolonization in world history, a native population returned after all this time. And, you know, and yet people don't see it that way. There is, to me, this kind of funny, you know, coming together like this. This way that in, you know, making these arguments, they've, you know, for one, they've done a complete 180, right, over like historical Zionist arguments. That if you go back and read, you know, your Theodore Herzl's, you know, your Jabotinsky's, you know, he was the sort of founder of what was then called revisionist Zionism, which is the sort of right wing of the Zionist movement that like is sort of a lineal ideological descent to Benjamin Netanyahu. These people, you know, would just write all this stuff about, we're bringing like, you know, European civilization in this savage place. But now you do have this sort of strange adoption of this anti-colonialist rhetoric by some Zionists who said, no. Well, if you think about it, right, really Jews are the indigenous people because there are these Jewish kingdoms there thousands of years ago. And so that's what grounds the claim to the land. And thinking about this, you know, got me thinking about the conversation that you and I had with Amber Frost, where we were talking about, you know, land acknowledgments. And, you know, and I think that people spend a lot of time having these very weird arguments about, you know, exactly whether the people that the Palestinians are currently, you know, the current Palestinians are descended from, you know, where exactly they lived 500 years ago or whatever. And people get very invested in this. And, you know, my view is that none of that should matter, that nobody's rights should depend on where their ancestors lived, that, you know, this is a sort of very basic, you know, question of the sort of foundational principles of the left, you know, going back to the French Revolution, is that everybody is born with the same package of rights, right? Nobody should have more or fewer rights than anybody else because of who their ancestors were, what, you know, ethnic, tribal, religious, racial group they come from. And this is, you know, the problem with, you know, the problem with Israel really has absolutely nothing to do with this sort of question of firstness. That it's like, okay, do we start the firstness clock, you know, 100 years ago or 150 years ago, or we start it like 2000 years ago? I don't think any of that matters. And I think one way of showing why it doesn't matter, at least to leftists, is to just ask yourself a very simple question, right? Like, imagine for the sake of argument, obviously this is not what happened in real history, right? But imagine for the sake of argument that the first Palestinian families had arrived in that territory like one generation before the first Zionist settlers showed up in the 1870s, or for that matter, that they'd showed up at the same time. Would anything that has happened since then be any more just or okay if that were the case, right? If you imagine, you know, Palestinians having showed up from other Arab countries in the 1870s at the same time as the first wave of Zionist settlers, would it then have been okay to ethnically cleanse them from big parts of the country in 1948 during the war that created Israel? Would it be okay to then deny those refugees the right of return? Would it be okay to absorb the West Bank into Israel for every legal and practical purpose, except for giving people their citizenship and relocate Israeli citizens there and give them all the rights that other Israelis have, while continuing to deny those rights to Palestinians there? It seems to me that all of those would be equally objectionable in that scenario, and that there is something, you know, and I know this is what pissed off certain segments of left Twitter and certain kinds of left academics when the article came out. But I think that the idea that there are, that like particular ethnicities have like innate genetic connections to certain pieces of land, is a very fundamentally reactionary idea. And that this is something that should just be rejected outright.
So you don't believe Jews were in Hollywood?
I'm not at privilege. I'm not at liberty to disclose that. But, you know,
you did relocate to your ancestral land.
You know, yeah, exactly. I recently made aliyah to Hollywood, so to, you know, live in LA. So yeah, I'm actually okay with that one.
But yeah, otherwise, I saw your executive producer credit on that M. Stone film. So at that point, I'm like, oh, I see. Back to his roots.
Gene, did you want to add to that?
No, I thought the reaction of certain elements of left Twitter to Ben's article was a little bit hysterical. People like to one-up each other and stuff like that. So we can put this kind of stuff aside. But the fact that people got so angry about it does speak to a fact that, you know, we can use terms like settler colonialism as a paradigm for understanding the creation of the State of Israel. We can talk about settlers in a kind of in a historical sense. Those are all legitimate ways to talk about the formation of the state of Israel. But I think what Ben gets at in his article is that in terms of a concrete solution and the way forward, that really doesn't have any bearing on the fundamentals of the problem. Whether the Palestinians appeared from the ground from nowhere in like 1940 or whether they're, you know, the indigenous people of this society, it doesn't change the fundamentals of why they should have equal rights, why they should have equal rights in this country. And I think the problem was, and again, I would distinguish between like a kind of an academic discussion over the process of nation forming in Israel and how we use certain terminologies and how certain terminology like colonialism and settler colonialism are useful for explaining the differences between one type of nation formation and another. That's all fine. But when these terminologies are imbued with a kind of certain moral righteousness to them, you end up with basically kind of an inverted just an inverted moral high ground. It becomes a who was here first and who has the concrete rights to this land dispute, which I find is a completely futile way. And for people who are pro-Palestinian, leads you into this ridiculous kind of argument over the which community was there first, like who is genetically the truest son of this particular land. And I feel that that is a completely pointless political argument, and the left not only shouldn't engage it but should actually actively avoid that kind of discussion. And I think back to something my dad told me years ago when he was a student in Baghdad. You know, as with many nationalist conflicts, you often have one side trying to delegitimize the existence of another side. And the Arabs would say Kurds are a made up nation. You know, they were made up 100 years ago. But my dad said, OK, that's all true. So we still want our equal rights. Doesn't matter if I came back. So I think Ben concretely on this point of the history, the deep history of Israel-Palestine and who was there first really is a complete distraction from what the fundamental issue is. And frankly, I think falling into that trap is a mistake. Not that the left matters at all, as they have no influence over policy. So this is basically arguing over the kind of, it's like a group of nerds arguing over how Danny de Villeneuve should direct the third part of the Dune movie. It's an interesting discussion, but we have no influence over that. But I think
Ben, I could actually help with that.
but I
you
thought
have some
I,
thoughts.
I thought Ben's core point as to, you know, who was there first and indigenous versus settler colonial, that is a useful historical paradigm to understand the question, but it's not a useful political paradigm to understand any type of left wing political solution to this based on the universal principles of 1789 or 1776, even though those principles are often, you know, hypocritically applied, they are kind of a good yardstick, I think, for us to base what would be a just solution to the Israel-Palestine question.
Kuba?
Now I'm going to shout at my son.
So let me observe something a little different, which is, why is it that the indigeneity debate has even become an issue? And why is there this response from certain segments of the left to anyone who refuses to forward claims of Palestinian indigeneity? And I think that there's a sense that with as little influence as the left has, the Gaza offensive is such a serious issue, and the status of Palestinians has been such a calamity for so long that we just use every rhetorical tool that we have, every rhetorical weapon. All we can do is tweet. All we can do is post. All we can do is talk. So don't deprive us of anything. If we can't beat them on political universalist program, then we'll beat them on this indigeneity thing. And when fighting Zionism, you can't adhere to the niceties of having a consistent intellectual position. I think that's a mistake, but I think that that's an attitude that's common on the left, even if many people won't necessarily admit to it. And for me, it's obvious that the indigeneity approach is one that's completely incoherent in the, if you try to apply it to any political question. Every piece of territory has had a history of settlement long enough so that different groups have been there at different times. No one evolved in situ, right? The Irish didn't climb out of the caves of...
Are you sure Donegal. About that? Are you sure about that?
Yeah, they pull themselves
they, one they by emerged one. From the bog. Bogs.
Jesus.
No, people arrived to the different modern nations that their descendants now inhabit in different waves. Some groups came earlier, some groups came later. And so the claim to indigeneity is one that gets bogged down in historical debates and reify the identities that we have today, the ethno-national groups that we belong to, with and then backwards project that these bones are Irish bones, these bones are Israeli bones, these bones are Palestinian bones. I don't know what the level of continuity is between the biblical Canaanites, who probably have the strongest claim to indigeneity in the Levant, and contemporary Israelis or contemporary Palestinians or Somalis or Yemenis. In all likelihood, everybody who has one ancestor from that region has a little bit of indigenous Israeli-Palestinian in them. But if you're leading a life on the other side of the planet, and this has nothing to do with your contemporary reality, then why should it matter? And similarly, if you don't have that blood quantum, but your family lives there, your life is there, you've been inhabiting there for generations, just not back in the Ooga Booga days, then why would that curtail the type of life that you can experience in the place that you live? And many contemporary states are organized along ethno-national lines. Poland, for instance, is an ethno-state. There's problems with that. There's reasons why it went that way instead of becoming a post-national or multi-ethnic or a state defined along other grounds. But that doesn't change the fact that we really should be considering the experiences, the needs, the rights of people who live in places at this moment in time that we can still help, that can still suffer, rather than backcasting to some idealized point where we start the indigeneity game.
Yeah.
Can I just add something?
Yeah.
There's nothing particularly unique about Israel either, right? The thing I always think about Israel, it's a nation, like a lot of other nations, which are invented in the modern era, number one. What makes Israel a little bit different is that it's like another nation, but it's like they did the wiring in a weird way. So now you can see all the wiring on the outside. So it looks superficially different. But at the end of the day, you know, you can situate the violence that's taking place in Israel, Palestine in a broader historical context. A lot of the people on the left today crying their eyes out on and rightly so, about what's happening in Gaza at the moment. It's absolute barbarism what's taking place there. But they've just spent the last 10 years shilling for the Assad regime, which has also deployed similar levels of sectarian violence against organizations and groups. You have a whole history of, from the early 20th century and the failure of the constitutional revolutions in the Middle East, a degeneration and retreat into, ethno-national violence. And that has different expressions in different regions. I think it's impossible to deny that there is a quote-unquote settler colonial aspect to the Israeli project, which isn't present in other parts of the Middle East. But at the end of the day, the crime is the crime. Whether you travel from across the sea to cut someone's throat and steal their land, or you do it to your next door neighbor, it's still the same fucking crime. Greeks and Turks, Greeks and Armenians lived alongside each other, and there were horrendous levels of theft and violence directed against those communities. Throughout the 80s and 90s, my family's people, Kurds, were ethnically cleansed and had their lands appropriated and taken. Today in Afrin, the Turkish government is settling Palestinian refugees from Israel in houses stolen from Kurdish families there. So, we should separate the kind of like the barbarism of Israel towards the Palestinians from the kind of hypocritical way that certain people start like freaking acting out about this issue and getting mad if you don't use the proper use the proper terminology, if you're not hardcore enough about being an anti-Zionist. What the fuck does Zionism mean today? It's 100 years ago, Zionism meant many different things. It's just Israeli nation state nationalism, and Israel has a particularly vicious and exclusionary nation state nationalism. But it's not something that's totally unique, that only exists in Israel. But for a variety of historical reasons, people in the West are either hysterically in favor of Israel or hysterically opposed to Israel. Like, what makes the Israel-Palestine question such a big question on the international scene is that there are a whole lot of groups that have a deep interest either in the survival of Israel as an ethno-state or, the destruction of Israel as an ethno-state for different reasons. But, there's nothing particularly unique about this problem, and there's nothing particularly strange about what Ben said, that the solution to this problem should be based upon, as far as possible, a notion of civic equality. And, people like crapping their pants about this and going like, liberal Zionist that, go fucking virtue signal in Toronto, right? Go, go where, no offense, Cuba, Canadians, but like, I'm really quite fucking sick of it, to be honest. I'm quite sick of it. I'm quite sick of all these assholes who for the last 10 fucking years have been making every excuse for the Assad regime to bomb the shit out of, they were Islamists. Well, guess what? Hamas are Islamists. You can fucking pretend that they're not Islamists, but they are Islamists. They don't have a political solution for any of this. And so, people getting mad at Ben for having, not framing the question precisely how they want to frame it is just the absolute pathology of the left. We could disagree. Like, I'll give credit where credit is due. Donald Parkinson from Cosmonaut, he disagreed with Ben and he laid out his reasons. I think he offered a fair critique, perhaps, according to how he is defining the term settler colonialism. But when we say settler colonialism, there are academic definitions, there are different academic definitions of the term, but then there's also the way that it's just used in political vernacular, just as a kind of like, settler colonialism means that you can go cut the throat of anybody. It's like, look, I think that if you're having a rave next to the Gaza Strip, right, and you're just like being hedonistic, it's kind of a little bit, there's something wrong with that. I think it shows a pathology in the society. I think you'd have to be a bit nuts to want to go rave next to the Gaza Strip. But the punishment for being a kind of selfish asshole shouldn't be getting killed, right? So, I think a lot of people are virtue signaling around the left. And, the hysteria from Zionists is always like, oh, this is all about anti-Semitism. Well, never assume anti-Semitism when brain-dead third worldism and Maoism could be a better reason why people are having such freaking dumb takes on this. Palestinian political organizations have better takes on this issue. PLO in the 70s is talking about a unified state for everyone. Even Hamas says that it doesn't want to mau-mau the entire Jewish population. Whether they really believe that or not, whether we could trust Hamas as a political
doubtful,
that's a different question. But if you're a like these absolute brain dead fucking morons who are like pretending that, you know, like Hamas is just a your friendly neighborhood nationalist organization. Well, like it's an Islamist freaking organization. Yeah, it's not Al Qaeda, but like, let's not pretend.
No, and I really like your point about how this is that how some of the like gray zone people, for example, because this might superficially sound like what Gene said, like I think a much worse argument that people will make, you know, that like Zionists will make, where they say, oh, why are you getting mad about this and not about this and that and the other thing, which is, you know, of course, just the sort of perennial whataboutery of defenders of anything that's indefensible, right? Like this is like you can go back to the 80s and find op-eds in defense of apartheid South Africa. They're like, oh, why are you talking about South Africa when there are all these human rights violations in all these other African countries? But that's not what he's saying, right? I mean, like, I think what Gene's saying, which is a very good point, is that like there are these certain kinds of campus, you know, there's the gray zone people, for example, who it's not just that they weren't focused on what was going on in Syria. It's, you know, because you could make an argument that, you know, you should prioritize the crimes that are being committed by your own state or its proxies, but it's that they were actively excusing it, and they're actively excusing it in ways that are obviously inconsistent with their much better views on Israel-Palestine, that that, you know, people would say, oh, well, you know, Assad is doing his okay because he's fighting Al-Qaeda, you know, which is, you know, a whole other thing, was always bizarre to me. But yeah, I did just want to say two things about this. One, you're certainly correct. I think both Gene and Kuba said versions of this, that it's not that the Israeli case is qualitatively unique. I think it's an extreme case, right? But it's not a qualitatively unique case. I mean, like just about any nationalism around the world has some level of ethno-nationalism in it. You know, that there are like countries where you have more or less of a civic nationalist tradition going against the ethno-nationalist tradition, but you know, the ethno-nationalist element is all, you know, is rarely entirely absent. You know, but it's the problem, the thing that leads to the wires on the outside is that Israel is in you know, is doing ethno-nationalism in demographic circumstances that basically makes it impossible to have an ethno-nationalist project without some pretty extreme ongoing human rights violations. You know, if you're, you know, if you're some relatively homogeneous country that, you know, in a different region of the world, you might be able to be pretty ethno-nationalist without having to do much of anything except for like maybe have restrictive immigration policies, which is also, you know, not great in itself. But whereas in the situation, you know, in the context of the demographic situation Israel's in, they end up having to, you know, to in order to maintain that ethno-nationalist project, they have to, you know, they've had to do all this ethnic cleansing. In the 40s and now, right? And deny, you know, like people they were ruling over for the last 56 years citizenship in Israel, because if they, you know, let them become citizens, that would throw off the demographic balance and Israel wouldn't get to exist as a Jewish state anymore, because there'd be roughly equal numbers of Jewish and Palestinian citizens. They end up doing things like they have a law that's been on books or keeps getting renewed, you know, for the last bunch of years, where if you're a Israeli Arab and you're an Arab citizen of Israel and you marry a West Bank Palestinian, you can't live together as a married couple in Israel, allegedly for security reasons, but pretty obviously for demographic reasons, right? So all this stuff is really obscene, which is why, you know, for many years I've had a pretty like straightforward anti-Zionist position. I don't think that Israel has a right to exist as a Jewish state. I don't think any country in the world has a right to maintain its ethnic majority by violating the rights of others. And you know, even if somebody told me that they think that the United States has a right to be a white state, and in defense of that right, we should have like exclusionary immigration policies that prevent non-white people from coming over, I would, you know, I would think that that person was a ugly bigot, and I'd have very little time for them, right? And like what Israel has done is much, much worse than that, right? So, which is why I've had this anti-Zionist position for a long time, and it's why one of the funny things about the last week is that usually my hate mail is, you know, one of the most reliable elements of my hate mail is Zionist hate mail. Because I'm usually, you know, I've usually written or said something recently that set them off. And so it's been very funny to spend the last week having a lot of people who are mad about this article describing me as a liberal Zionist, which is, you know, kind of amazing. And, you know, and sometimes, you know, in the, you know, like on Twitter, since there's something very wrong with me and I engage with this stuff way more than I should, that like I will sort of press people on some of this. And yeah, I think the logic of the position ends up taking them to crazy places, right? So if you, you know, if you extend the concept of a settler, and clearly in the article, I'm not talking about people who are using that term in a sort of very abstract, refined academic way to mean the privileged caste of a settler colonial state, you know, that like you no longer be a settler if, you know, if you changed the political system. But, you know, people who say, oh, you know, all Israelis are settlers, where oftentimes the next sentence is settlers aren't civilians, or, you know, I'm not going to get mad at indigenous people, you know, doing anything to settlers, or if you really believe in a right of return, you know, you should be okay with mass displacing Israelis to restore the exact land arrangements of an undeveloped country in the 1940s. And, you know, I had somebody on Twitter the other day telling me, oh, like using presenting as if it was a reductio ad absurdum of the view. It's like, oh, so would you be against, you know, would you have a problem with what the Algerians, you know, did to, you know, the French settlers? I was like, yeah, I mean, I think Algerian independence is good. Killing random French civilians is bad. That's
I'll go even further, Ben. I'll go even further than this. I would say that the displacement from of Germans from Prussia and other parts of Silesia was probably not a good thing to have happened.
No, it's not. I mean, in fact, it's really funny because, like, I saw somebody else who one of the others sort of like, oh, which well, in that case,
it's what the Zionists will argue that they're doing to the Palestinians, because they'll put that, they will say, like, you know, I've heard people I know who are hardcore Zionists say, like, well, you know, after the Second World War, Germans were pushed out of Prussia and Silesia.
Yes, which is horrible. I mean, there's an old Nathan Robinson article from Current Affairs. I do not remember what it's called, but it's the one about Ben Shapiro. It might be called The Cool Kids Philosopher. So it's one of those classic Nathan Robinson 10,000 word takedowns of some reactionary figure. And in part of it talks about this old article that Shapiro had written many years ago that he sort of apologized for. That where he said he advocated the mass transfer of all Palestinians out of the country. And he said, oh, if you think this is genocide or whatever, it's like, no, it's not Hitler, it's Churchill. And then he mentioned the transfers of ethnic Germans out of those areas in Eastern Europe at the end of World War II. And Nathan goes into like long quotes from historians about what that process looked like in practice, which is just as horrific as you would think it would be, because there really are not a lot of examples of nice ethnic cleansing in world history. So it's like, yes, of course, that was an awful thing. That was a thing that should not have happened. That's, you know, everybody, like, nobody deserves to have fewer rights because they're a member of the wrong ethnicity, whether wrong ethnicity means the one you think is inferior, or wrong ethnicity means the one that, you know, where members of that ethnicity haven't been around as long, or they came under the wrong circumstances, or anything, right? So, and this is not, and I think this is a very, like, deep ideological confusion by parts of the contemporary left. So, for example, I was reading Naomi Klein's book, the new one from last year, Doppelganger, And Naomi Klein is somebody I basically like. I think she's, you know, right about most things, but like, I think she is very fond of identity politics. You know, like I think she sort of buys into all the identity politics catechisms in a way that I'm not crazy about. And that, you know, and there's a point where she's talking about the protests, like the, after the discovery of the evidence of bodies buried by residential schools in Canada. And she's talking about the national reckoning in response to this. And she says, and she refers to herself as a settler. She says, you know, settlers like me. And she says, that, you know, we can learn how to, you know, be better guests and neighbors on this land. And I remember reading that and thinking, wait a second, you think you're a guest? You think that like you have less of a right to live in Canada because of your race, because of who your ancestors were? I mean, if somebody who, like a Guatemalan immigrant in Vancouver who just became a citizen 3 days ago, I'm sure Naomi Klein would quite rightly rebuke anybody who referred to that person as a guest and said that like it wasn't really their country in the way that it's really the country of Canadians who are born there. And so I'm very, very confused about what the principle is that, you know, that you say that like, oh, you know, if, you know, that because Naomi Klein isn't descended from the right bloodlines, you know, she's just a guest in the country. I think that's a very unhealthy thing. I think that's impossible to reconcile with left principles. And the last thing I just want to get in here is that I think that oftentimes with this stuff, there is you know, especially when you talk about land back and all of that, I think that there's a very libertarian conception of justice going on here, a very not leftist conception of justice. If you think about like the last section of Capital, when so there are 8 sections of that book. The last section is the one on primitive accumulation, talks about the enclosures, the process by which, you know, the majority of English and Scottish people were driven off of their land, in the process of the rise of capitalism. And of course, the conclusion is, well, of course, there's no turning back the clock, but this expropriation lays the groundwork for expropriating the expropriators and creating this better society. And that same kind of distinction is the distinction between somebody like Rawls and somebody like Nozick, that that a left liberal philosopher like Rawls is looking at, okay, how equal or fair is the distribution of resources right now? And a libertarian like Nozick is looking at, oh, did it come about the right way? And I'd say if you have a conception of justice that's about trying to turn back the clock to the property arrangements of some point in the past, rather than trying to create a more equal society going forward, I think you have landed on the wrong end of a really fundamental divide.
Yeah, let me just add a little historical context to that as well. If we look at the history, and this is not my area of expertise by any means, but I have some passing familiarity with the academic literature on this. If we look at the territory that comprises Israel-Palestine today, you know, the privatization of land and the creation of modern capitalist relations, you know, dates back from the Ottoman period. And many of the problems that gave rise to, that are directly linked to the kind of Israel-Palestine issue today, we see those coming into being because, for example, land is privatized. Landowners in Beirut and Damascus get control of that land and then sell that land from underneath the peasantry's feet, right? So returning back necessarily to a pre-Nakba set of economic relations in Palestine is not something that can be done. It's not realistic, and it's not even desirable. You know, when we talk about land, you know, the complete nationalization of land by a binational state would probably be an important precondition to resolving these issues, not having to re-adjudicate, you know, capitalist land relations. Anyway, sorry, I jumped in there.
Cooper?
Yeah, I could tell that some of the examples cited were intended to bait me into a response. Wrocław, Szczecin, these are and have eternally been Polish cities with true Slavic blood mixed in the mortar, the clay of every brick, the very structures.
Which was just because it was the cheapest building supply available at the time.
Exactly, exactly. The children's blood was actually there. You get less per unit, but it sticks better. But I think that I don't find anything to object with the notion that expelling millions of civilians from their homes, places that they've lived for generations, places that they want to continue to live, is a positive, acceptable course of action, regardless of if those civilians are Palestinians or Israelis or Jews or Germans or Poles. And one reason why we need to be careful about entertaining arguments about indigeneity and historical claims to land is because it leads to that kind of ethnic cleansing. If there's one justification for inhabiting territory, and that is indigeneity, and it is not something that can be shared, ultimately, everyone else needs to leave, right? Is there merely at the sufferance of the people who belong to that bloodline? It's a literal bloodline. And the West, the contemporary international legal system, has tried since World War II in different ways, maybe even earlier in some idealist communities, to move away from notions that tie blood and soil together. Different countries have had different levels of success. Canada, my much maligned Canada, is actually a pretty good example of a country where that link between blood and soil is not the basis of your mm-hmm. rights as a Canadian, although actually the engagement with First Nations land claims and things like land acknowledgement rituals reopen that debate, except with a different group privileged as the holy landlords. I'm not going to apologize for the expulsion of Germans after World War II. I think that once the mechanisms of blood and soil ethnic warfare start rolling, then this is precisely what happens. And it's precisely why we need to stop them, why we need to prevent land disputes from being understood, defined, justified in these terms. And it's not an isolated incident, right? Ironically, Vladimir Putin, in the debate that in his interview with Tucker Carlson, the one where Ben and I did an analysis, he uses historical claims and justifications and letters from Bogdan Khmelnytsky to justify the invasion of Ukraine and presumably at some point either an ethnic cleansing or some kind of partition of Ukrainian territory. And the reality, too, is that as your empire expands and you absorb new areas which have their own historical claims, this process can go on forever. You can use it to justify ultimately imperial, universal empire by saying that, well, when we absorbed Ukraine, then that meant that we're the inheritors of the Kievan Rus, which means that Belarus and the Baltic states that had Varangian settlements also belong to us. And once you take the Baltic, well, because of our stewardship of the Baltic tribes, right? It's actually the entire coast all the way to Denmark that belongs to us on an indigeneity claim. And I believe that this is, when it's not forwarded as an emanation of some kind of mystical, historic, mythologized history, like you get claims from the Old Testament or going back all the way to Noah's Ark to justify Israeli occupation of Palestine, Israel, the West Bank. Now, those people believe in it, but it's wrong. Other people like Putin are just using it as an instrument to manipulate opinion and to try to reorder what is an invasion and a conquest into some type of liberatory campaign.
Gene, did you want to say something?
Yeah, and I agree. I agree with Cuba. Once you set in motion a kind of ethno-national politics, you know, it has a chain reaction that leads to the degeneration of society, the fragmenting of people, the unmixing of people, to use a kind of more academic phraseology about it. And, you know, ideologically, really, you know, I think Ben is right in highlighting, as much as people don't like to hear it, but like a lot of these arguments merely just kind of invert the nationalist logic of the other side's argument. You know, we see this everywhere with identity politics. You know, Ibram X. Kendi is the intellectual heir of Strom Thurmond, right? that's what it is. Once you center the issue on adjudicating historical barbarisms, well, guess what? History is a litany of barbarism, and we can all pick and choose which barbarisms we want to emphasize and which we don't want to emphasize in order to construct the nationalist narrative. I think it was Renan who said, you know, nations is not just about remembering, it's also about forgetting certain things that happened in the past. So, you know, if we want to have, and I think large parts of the left, or the so-called left, are under the influence of an extremely right-wing preposition, an extremely right-wing kind of premise of their politics is in the sense that they don't reject nationalism, identity politics, and racism, but rather they think that the solution to these historical injustices is merely inverting the normative values associated with particular ethno-national racial groups. We can look historically at how nations and communities and conflicts take place. We can even apportion blame for these conflicts. But critically, as Cooper, I think, is hinting at, you know, he doesn't need to apologize for the ethnic cleansing of Germans from Poland, because he didn't fucking do it, right? You know, he wasn't involved in doing it. Collective guilt is another extremely pernicious thing. You know, a lot of these people claim to be freaking Marxists. Well,
but what if people say that Cuba inherited the benefits of that ethnic cleansing?
Well, Poland's not much really benefit to inheriting.
Wow.
No. All right. No, that would have been my response as well.
But you know, even if you know, like
this is also,
I don't, I mean, also, like, you know,
let's actually dwell on that thought a little bit, right? That they, Cuba is inheriting the benefits, or that, you and I, even if neither of us exactly have lineages that go back to the Mayflower, are inheriting the benefits of the dispossession of Native Americans, or
I think Zal does, though.
Zal. Oh yeah, Zal for
Zal's
sure.
Mother,
for
Zal's sure. Mother is the daughter of the American Revolution.
Yeah, well, also, of course, you know, I really like Uri Strauss. Did a Medium post that was inspired by my article, where he ran the numbers to show that like almost everybody in the world is descended from almost everybody who lived, you know, more than, you know, like a few hundred years ago, basically, right? Like, just because the, you know, it takes the tiniest little bits of intermixing to make that like mathematically guaranteed, even in pretty isolated communities. But yeah, look, I mean, I think that they, you know, because I think there is also something that's like really deeply reactionary about this idea. Right. Because if we're talking about ordinary working class people in Poland or Canada or the United States or anywhere else, right, they have and you're saying, well, the thing that's sort of objectionable here is, even if they didn't do it, right, they inherited the benefit of doing it. Well, what what's the benefit that you're talking about exactly? Right? Like it's if you think about that they're allowed to live there. I mean, surely we think everybody should be allowed to live there. I mean, I think that, all else being equal, immigration restrictions are very bad, right? Or or is it just that they kind of have a decent life with an okay standard of living? Is that like a special benefit that is suspect? I don't think so. I think that everybody, right, should have that. I think everybody should, in fact, I think that the vast majority of people in these societies don't have nearly a good enough life. Otherwise, I wouldn't be a socialist, right? Like, I think that if I'm a socialist, if I object to the current economic system, it's because I don't think it is delivering nearly as good a life to the majority of the population in these countries as it should. So when you start saying, oh, that, you're benefiting from this like unearned privilege of living here and having like a decent life, it's like, no, it's not nearly good enough. We should demand better.
Yeah, I would
chime in too that when there is a case of dispossession, genocide, ethnic cleansing, whether it's occurring in Gaza, whether it occurred in Bosnia, Croatia, Serbia, and there are individuals that can be held responsible as well as individuals that can be compensated, that should be part of a measured, responsible policy, a program. Punish people who do the bad things and try to make people whole as much as possible, as far as you can, that have experienced this kind of dislocation. When it comes to the descendants of individuals who may or may not have done things, well, are all American whites descended from colonists and slavers? Well, presumably a whole bunch of them. Presumably a whole bunch of them are not, but they could be descended from Sicilian pirates and upcountry brigands in Scotland that have also done terrible things and their descendants somehow benefit from. I don't think that there's an individual responsibility to anyone based on their descent to try to remediate some kind of ancient injustices. And I think that many states, Canada included, moving towards some kind of reconciliation and compensation for colonized peoples and their descendants, that's appropriate. It should be organized through states. States are the actors in many of these that committed these types of crimes. They're the bodies that represent and last transhistorically connects the current situation with previous epochs, and they're available to do something about it. Now, I think that rather than looking at it from the point of view of some restoration, from a material perspective, like Ben said, everyone should, based on this level of productivity in the global economy, based on the countries that we live in and the wealth that's been piled up by all of these dead generations, people should have more, a lot more, and it should be universally and broadly shared. Not on the basis of your ancestors being criminals or your ancestors being victims, but on the basis of our shared common personhood. And ideally, that would take care of the material issue, and the reconciliation process would be one having more to do with culture, more to do with recognition, and more to do with establishing a shared society that acknowledges the problems of the past rather than just brushing them off the table or celebrating them as great national achievements.
I think that's pretty fair enough. I think yeah, we have like a big nationalism problem on the left that we refuse to deal with. I mean, to return to a lot of the discourse about Israel-Palestine, certainly, like when we look at like what's happening in Israeli society now, we're looking at a society that's like going through a real barbarous degeneration into like bloodthirsty behavior. You know, if you want to see, if you want to see a quote unquote democratic society descend into madness, you can just flip on TikTok right now, because more than anything the left is doing, is the IDF on TikTok is doing for the Palestinian cause, because people see what's going on. People see what the IDF and large segments of the Israeli public are doing. But if we, you know, from a political sense, almost being like having your dichotomy as like it's the indigenous Palestinians versus the Israeli settlers, just seems like a bad political stance as well. Because, I mean, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong. Ben, you know a lot more about Marxism and the history of Marxism than I do. But I think, like, traditionally, a lot of people on the left used to be all about splitting the working class away from their ruling class. And by reinforcing that discourse about, like, oh, you know, all Israelis are guilty, well, yeah, then they're going to fight to the death, right? It's just, yeah, like, it's just like people who go and like, white people this, white, just like, do you really want white people to start thinking themselves as white people and acting collectively at white people? No, you want to exploit the fissures within that society.
Yeah, as I believe Kuba said, I think I think it's probably a bad idea in the long term to encourage white people to spend more time thinking about their whiteness. Exactly. That historically leads nowhere good, right?
Like, and let's not forget, the Palestinian ruling class as well has been hook and crook in this, either as kind of stooges for the Israeli occupation force, or as being a pretty socially reactionary Islamist political organization. So, you know, people on the left talk a freaking big game, but, you know, they don't believe in their principles. And I frankly believe a lot of the fucking hysteria on the Western left about Gaza is less about fucking Gaza and more about a bunch of failed leftists in the West. Millennial de left fucking packed it in and fucked up. We missed our chance. We missed the fucking boat. And we're in the same shitty position we were 8 years ago. It's just that you can like fucking find a DSA chapter now and again around the place. We're in the same shitty position. So because we've been defeated here, we've now projected out our fantasies
in spite of the fact that we finally have our democratic standard bearer uncommitted.
But that said, right? Look, I don't disagree that the left in America in 2024 is profoundly fucked. I mean, you'd have to be very delusional not to see that. And I also don't disagree that some of the people who are like the maddest about the article, for example, do sort of.
Well, let's say it. Fucking Aaron Maté, that fucking psychopath scumbag who is shilled for the Assad regime, which has killed millions of people in the name of fighting Islamism, because, you know, the people they were fighting were assholes too, butchered the people of Aleppo. And this son of a bitch is being lauded by the fucking left as being, look, he does good journalism. It may be motivated journalism. He does good journalism. But his lack of consistency and his utter sociopathy is just fucking nuts. So the guy can go fuck himself in the ass, along with the rest of those fucking gray zone cunts. Like, let's be honest. Like,
Max, man, you weren't hoping to monetize this, were you, Jason?
Yeah. Look at those dead eyes, right? Dead eyes, right?
This is FBI agent. I'm also.
Anyway, that's enough for me today.
I'm also not a fan of Mr. Maté, but on the more general point, who did, by the way, lie about the article.
Fucking lie. Lying son of a bitch.
But quoted in a very misleading way and kind of summarized the argument in almost the opposite of the, you know, he sort of like took it as a, is, you know, oh, Israelis are the real indigenous ones, which is almost the opposite of the point, right? So that's the Aaron Maté piece. But put it aside, you know, I understand that the most important thing is which other people in left media I have beefs with. That's like obviously what we should focus on. But
it's not about you having beefs with other people in left media. It's about whole sections of left media crying their fucking eyes about Gaza, acting like their only concern is humanitarianism, after we've spent the last goddamn decade these people shilling for a whole bunch of indefensible regimes. Look, if you're going to be consistent about things and you don't like these horrible ethnic regimes, then, you know, like, let's be fair about them behind, around the board. But if the Palestinians were getting U.S. aid to fight Israel, a Chinese proxy, these very same people would be like defending Israel's right of existence. Just like you see all these contrarian leftists in Spiked magazine. And who's that? Who's that? The Frank Faroudi guy. All these people who cry all day about identity politics and the West is killing everybody. But all of a sudden, there's a terrorist attack in Israel, and they've all become the biggest defenders of Jewish ethnic exceptionalism, and how, like, the only way for the Jewish people to be safe is to have their own ethnostate. None of these motherfuckers are consistent. Like, at least have bad politics and be consistent. The, you know, it's like, I don't know. I'm fed up with
that. Yeah. So I agree.
Let me cut you off real quick here, Ben. Let me cut you off real quick here, Ben, and just make a public service announcement for TIR. The statements made by Jean Bajelon. you know, here, I'll.
I'll sound unhinged, Charles. You go fuck yourself, you dumb fuck.
Okay,
you
Gene, are man. Gene. Yeah. First of all, can we not fuck anybody? This is a fuck-free show. It's a fuck-free zone. I do want to say something.
Look, you know and I know that if there's going to be fucking, it's in the champagne room. but I did just want to make one one actual substantive point and one plug, because I know we're like wrapping, you know, we're nearing, you know, the end time here. That, you know, I do agree with a lot of what Gene says. I wouldn't put it as colorfully, but I agree with a lot of what he says about certainly the hypocrisies of certain kinds of third worldists. And also on the sort of bad structural position of the left right now. Right. Like, obviously, you know, things are grim. It would be ridiculous to deny that. But I do also, you know, I don't want to, you know, just attribute what you're talking about to that, because the fact is that you did get a, 100,000 people in my home state, 10 times as many as the Trump-Biden difference in 2016, voting uncommitted, which I actually find incredibly encouraging. And you do have a lot of people who are not just like powerless lefties. You have a lot of normies who are actually very, very angry about what they're seeing on their TV screens right now, what they're seeing if they see these deranged IDF TikToks that Gene is talking about. To, you know, the point that there, you know, there really is. It's not just like the left, you know. I'm the canceling comedians guy. I'm never going to deny the existence of left ridiculousness. It's real. But quite separate from that, right? There really is a tidal wave of, I think, authentic, organic anger about this. I mean, there are polls where 50% of the people who voted for Biden in 2020 think that what's going on right now is a genocide. And, you know, 30% aren't sure. This is a real thing, and it's an important thing, and it's right. Right. And this is like, you know, that, you know, I counted up before, you know, this is, this article is the, depending on how you count it, the 16th or 17th thing I've written for Jacobin about Israel, Palestine. I think just since October. This is something I care about a lot, and I have for a long time. I have, it's been an issue with people in my life in the past, right? You know, how much this issue is a big deal to me, right? This is, and I think, and I, you know, but the way that the reason I've always been an anti-Zionist is because I believe in human rights, and I believe that human rights are for all humans. And I think that that's enough, right?
But who are the humans?
God, that's grim. So, you know, I mean, this is like, this is my article where, you know, I'm, you know, I am venting at like a lot of rhetoric I see online that I don't like, and that, you know, my long-term frustration with why I think land acknowledgments are reactionary ethno-nationalism. That is something I've been saying for years. I don't think anything is the land of any ancestral group. But the whole point is to frame anti-Zionism in a way that is plausible and actually makes sense in principle. And by the way, I think is a lot more likely to move more people, because I think most normies are more likely to be won over by "you can't do this to human beings" than all members of indigenous groups, you know, should have.
But I think we all agree, and in my lifetime, I've never seen such support for a ceasefire from people that are, for the most part, apolitical. Right.
I'm definitely saying that.
And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that beyond mainstream media, and I've said this before and I'll say it again, Elon Musk kind of saying fuck it with Twitter. This is a political project for him. And I don't know if this is a backfire or not, but because they let people go willy-nilly with the images, we can see 24/7.
Oh, 100%.
What's going on?
And Jason, I would just jump in quickly here, like 100%, because, you know, for years there's a kind of gaslighting discourse around Israel is the only democracy, the Palestinians are like this, Israel is the most moral army in the world. Mm-hmm. We're sitting here, right, watching videos of the of what the IDF is doing, rifling through women's underpants, executing old women, bombing people, creating a famine, starving people. You have to be deluded not to see that this is a genocidal campaign. At the same time, we're seeing that these, you know, Hamas did atrocities, but we're seeing a lot of sensationalism. And I'll give credit to that SOB Aramate for reporting this, is that, you know, a lot of these claims about the mass rape, where's the evidence? Like, you could persuade me if you showed me evidence, but like, you aren't showing me evidence. Where were these babies? So people, I think, are feeling that they've been chumped. Yeah. They've been chumped for years and years. They've been lied to. And the Israelis haven't helped themselves, because in the last 10 years, with the rise of these populist white people, there is a kind of degeneration in the abilities of the professional managerial class to perform Westernness in the name of Israel and to get Israel's message across. Because you just have straight up like religious lunatics like my Kurdish brother Ben-Gvir, who should be making people unhappy in Kurdistan and not in Palestine, if the world was just. And all these people are just like totally just not even playing the game anymore of trying to like sugarcoat what's happening for Western liberals. And people are seeing with their own eyes. It's been building up for 10 years, but this is just absolute, straight up, vile, disgusting barbarism. And what makes it so disgusting is that when you looked at the barbarism of a regime like Assad or the militias in Iraq or what happened in Azerbaijan, Armenia, these are dictatorial, very like extremely authoritarian dictatorial regimes. Like, we don't know how much public support these regimes really have. But in Israel, like, you know, Israelis like to go and blame the Palestinians for voting for Hamas when most of them were like, you know, still in the womb or twinkle in their parents' eyes at the time. But the Israeli public voted for these lunatics, right? So this, you know, this is like quite disturbing, I think. People, I would still hesitate to say let's collectively blame all Israelis, but there does seem to be a certain amount of popular support for what is genocide.
And I would, I think that building on the idea of how do you reach normies, why are normies reacting to this? If you think about the revulsion towards the Axis powers during World War II. Mm-hmm. Some of that was ideological, but the centrality of the Holocaust in condemnations of the Third Reich, that's something that's retroactively projected onto that period. Most people didn't even know about it. Most people, it was a niche issue. But there was a basic disgust with the sheer brutality, the unreasonable savagery of fascist forces, wherever they invaded, wherever they occupied. A feeling that this type of overt, large-scale, unapologetic, in-your-face violence and deceit, you know, who are you going to trust, me or your lying eyes? That is one thing that transcends any type of political affiliation and reaches people at their basic humanity. And this is what I think we're experiencing right now. The reality of what's going on in Gaza, you can't really dress it up. You can't really spin it once you've seen it. The reaction to the initial incursion by Hamas and the slaughter of hundreds, over 1,000 Israelis also triggered that kind of reaction. And Israel could have, like the United States after September 11th, with a restrained policy, with something that recognized the humanity of the Palestinians and focused the retribution onto people who were directly involved and not this insanely disproportionate collective punishment, could have cultivated that feeling, that sentiment around the world for its favor. But not only has it squandered it, but through this response, with its visible brutality, its deceptiveness, its utter contempt for any kind of limits based on our notions of human rights, that's what's getting you such a groundswell of support for Palestine.
Well, on that note,
yeah. Sorry. I did. I just
looting the shit out of me on my own show.
No, I just feel like if I don't do the necessary bit of self promotion here, they're not going to keep making me associate producer on all those movies. So, he clearly doesn't have the instinct, you know.
You're a star kid.
Exactly. I have always loved that culturally sensitive impression that you do. So as I said, in this case, I think there's a, way of doing anti-Zionism wrong. That's something that, I was trying to address in this article, but of course 99% of what I've written about this has just been, doing straightforward, arguing against, spurious defenses for, Israeli war crimes, arguing, against Zionism, et cetera. And, in that, that's always been my primary, interest in this. And so anybody who might be watching in my home state, Michigan, I saw somebody, making a hurtful comment about my beautiful Lansing Community College shirt in the chat. But anybody who's watching in my home state in Michigan, next Thursday, so Thursday the 21st in Detroit at Wayne State University, Old Main Building, room 103 at 6:00. I'm going to be giving a talk that's co-sponsored by Detroit DSA and another DSA chapter. I do not remember off the top of my head. My apologies for that. That is just called Debunking the Many Bad Arguments Made by Israel's Apologists in the West. So, you should come out, if you think I suck, you should still come out and say so in the Q&A, because that'll make it a more interesting Q&A.
I think it's time that you have your Norm Finkelstein moment and make a shut up. Shut up.
Yeah.
My mother's from Cleveland.
Yes, that's all I'm gonna do in the Q&A. I'm just gonna do my most high pitched voice and tell people to shut up. As is my custom. He's gonna be backstage so people won't know he's there, but I'm gonna bring Gene with me. And then, if there's like a particularly spicy Q&A question, I'm sorry, we have a special guest. I'm gonna do it like a Jerry Springer episode, and he's gonna start screaming.
Well, no, we could slip in Diablo on instead.
Your brother, the wrestler. I don't know, Gene. If your brother's a wrestler, you're doing a great job of being the manager that gets the wrestler hyped up. Because
I'll be the hype man for the wrestler. I'm telling you.
I think we're all pretty hyped. I don't know what you could possibly say in the champagne room.
I've got some things to say.
Oh my god!
If that's
what's going on the main stage, just imagine the champagne. Oh,
Jesus Christ! I'm excited now. In all fairness, we've been all having our own little issues with the world in which we exist in this online media thing, and we've all had our own personal conversations with each other. I definitely had one with Jean Bajelan earlier today. A little bit. I didn't know that he was saving it all up for tonight. So I'm excited for the champagne room. If you are watching the show on Ben Burgess's channel, I'll give them an argument. He also has a link. And he will be having it for his patrons as well. Yeah. So wherever you're watching.
When I posted it, I said the champagne room was going to start 10 minutes ago, but whatever. It'll start soon.
Well, they got free champagne. All you guys got some free champagne. I want to thank everyone for watching. Comments, even if you disagreed with what was said on the screen, I appreciate your engagement in this conversation. Wherever you're watching this show, be it on This Is Revolution or Give Them an Argument, there should be a link in the description to Ben's article. And if you disagree with it, if you disagree with any of the comments, leave a comment and tell us how you really feel.
Jean Bajelan style.
That's the best way to, you really want to get under anyone's skin on the screen? Leave one of those long essay length comments.
Those are kind of sounds like you're agreeing, but you're also like shivving them.
Oh man, I love it.
Well, I did enjoy. There was I don't usually catch Majority Report anymore, because I work at that time. But the other day I had it on, and they had a caller who I think was a Black Power Media fan who came on.
Oh yeah,
calling him and all I could think about is like, Jared Ball's Jewish.
Isn't that what we're on right now? Black Power Media, isn't that what this stream is? That
you having an unnatural allegiance to losers is not like you.
That's a joke. I'm just joking.
I'm sorry. I get the names of shows confused. This is the Revolutionary Blackout Network.
Oh, now this one is not a joke.
You have been an unnatural like
the first one, total joke. The second one,
look, I just don't think it's appropriate to make jokes about people with learning difficulties on this show, okay? So let's go to the champagne room.
You know what? Hold on. Gene, you deserve this for the main show. And we never do this on the main show, but you deserve this because you kind of killed it.
Here it comes!
You kind of deserve that, Gene Bajelan. Wherever you are watching this show, there are links to our Patreon where we have the link up for our champagne room. You, for just $3 a month or $30 for the year, you can have access to champagne rooms past and present. We are doing a movie night this Friday, which should be a good time. Jason, I have no problem with Jared Ball and the Black Power Media people. I think Jared.
He does good interviews. Jared Ball does good interviews.
Jared is a nice. He wrote a very important book, and Jared does something that none of us can do. He pissed off a Grammy Award-winning rapper so much the dude wrote a diss song about him.
You wrote a diss song about Jared Ball?
Yeah, Jared Ball fucking got under Killer Mike's skids. I mean, he was right.
Jared Ball, critical support for Jared Ball and his war against Killer Mike.
So, yeah. So, there you go. That, we can joke. You know, Pascal's gone on the show. They don't have me on for whatever reason.
Yeah.
But anyway. If you're listening on Apple, subscribe. You can get a link to the Champagne Room as well. You can hear the more unhinged rants of my good friend, Mean Gene Bajelon. And let's just calm it down a little bit with cartoons. Thank you, guys. We'll be back tomorrow with Big Waz and Coach Will. We're talking some basketball. We are out.